Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
So here we are, late summer 2021, and over the last year, the Portland area and most of the Pacific Northwest has seen a 100-year wildfire season,
helicopters are dropping water on the white,
a generational ice storm,
90,000 customers are still,
and a heat wave that shattered records.
63 deaths can likely be attributed to that.
For me, and a lot of you, those events hit home. Every few months, stark reminders that something is changing about our weather.
You or someone you know lost power, at least once.
An entire region got buried in a blanket of bad air that was dangerous to breathe.
A lot of people died.
Hundreds of people died.
116 Oregonians have now died as a result of the state's recent...
The climate is changing. Whether the shift in our weather can officially be blamed on human-caused global warming or natural environmental variability remain points of contention and heated debate. A debate that won't be held on this platform. At least, not in this project. Climate change is not up for debate. It is a fact.
This record-breaking temperature
and limbs just toppled
to the ground. It continues to threaten thousands of buildings.
At least four lives.
For all intents and purposes, this town is gone.
And while we may not be able to blame climate change alone for causing more extreme weather, the evidence is clear. It is not helping. And it is getting worse.
And it is getting worse.
Oregon City extending its state of emergency declaration until mid-March.
When you factor in a strong wind and then ongoing dry conditions, it really makes
That's a real change from 20 years ago.
I think Mother Nature is very mad at humans.
So we're going to go on a journey. A journey to examine the weather events of the recent past.
You know, these small decisions that we all make in our day-to-day lives, they do really have consequences. They have impacts. They add up.
The groundbreaking research of the present.
You can pretty much rule out a lot of things that are not caused by humans.
And a journey to try and understand how everything is going to change in the near and distant future.
It gives me hope that policymakers continue to try to turn this around.
Along the way, we hope to provide you with a look at how we got here and the historical context of what is actually going on.
There's more energy in the atmosphere, we know that, and that is going to cause more extreme weather.
We'll take a look at what is happening and what will inevitably continue.
The crises we're going to be facing from climate change are really going to balloon and intersect with other crises.
And there's some scary stuff there.
Like end of days kind of scary stuff.
What climate change is contributing to is basically an increased frequency, duration, and severity of these extreme events.
But there's also opportunity with adaptation. And the potential, through mitigation and the decisions we make now, to forever alter the path of human evolution.
Humans are really good at turning even tragedy into a profit-making opportunity.
I'm Ian Costello. Join us as the Coin Podcast Network goes beyond the headlines to take a first-of-its-kind look at a climate in crisis.
These small decisions that we all make in our day-to-day lives, they do really have consequences. They have impacts. They add up.
Fires that we've had, the high temperatures that we've had, the droughts that we've had, it's like coming home to roost, right? These things are impacting us right now, today.
We still have really limited knowledge about where and how this destabilizing climate system is going to really push its acute and intense effects on communities.
So how do we measure fairness in our planning? How do we include all communities in planning?
My name is Kelly Bairn, and I'm the morning meteorologist at Coin 6 News.
Kelly, did you grow up in a city?
I did. I was up north in Seattle, Washington.
What would you say you like most about the city lifestyle?
That's a tough question to nail down. There's a lot that I liked, and it's great to live in Portland, too. This is a big city. So I think having the diversity, meeting all sorts of people from different places around the U.S. and the world was just awesome to get some new perspective on life. But also the opportunities in a big city are great. You know, there's a lot of jobs, a lot of places to eat, a lot of entertainment that comes by, you know, big movies, big artists go there first. So I think there's just a lot that a big city has to offer.
We know, anybody who's listening to this knows, that you love to spend your time outside and you do a lot of stuff out of the city. But would you consider yourself a city girl at heart?
I don't know. I think if I were to live near an outdoor area or, you know, an outdoor mecca of climbing, snowboarding, you know, all that stuff, I think I'd be okay, because I did spend some time in Eastern Washington, and I actually loved it. You know, there were some things to get used to, some differences from a big city, but I was so close to a lot of rock climbing, and that's what I fell in love with. So I do see myself staying in a big city for the rest of my life.
The reason I ask is because after we went through our extreme weather events in episode one of this series, and then talked about the more rural industries of timber and agriculture in episode two, this week, we're going into the city.
Yeah, it's an important place to look at in terms of climate change. But before we get there, Ian, we should probably get people caught up quickly on a few of the specifics and some of the ground we've covered so far. Like you mentioned in our first episode, we took a deep dive into the extreme weather events we've seen in our area the last 13 months or so. The Labor Day firestorms, all the wildfires that exploded last year, the ice storm of February, and the heat dome where Portland saw our hottest temperatures ever on record. That was in June. The most important takeaway from that first episode is that climate change is not causing these events. Fire seasons, winter weather, heat waves, they're all natural occurrences. But climate change and the overall warming of the Earth, thanks to carbon emissions, is turning those extreme events into historical events. Those are certainly more dangerous. And as we saw this past year, more deadly.
And then in our second episode, we really dove into a couple of the industries with a huge presence here in the Pacific Northwest, agriculture and timber, to find out how continued climate change is affecting them and consequently all of us. And it's scary for a lot of reasons. But the big talking point from that second episode, and what I think we made pretty clear, is that climate change is an economic issue, and one that needs to be addressed if industries that rely on natural resources are going to survive.
And now, Ian, as we continue on this journey to better understand how climate change is going to impact life in the city, let's meet our experts who helped explain it to us.
My name is Amanda Howell, and I am a researcher with the Urbanism Next Center at the University of Oregon, based in Portland.
My name is Vivek Shandis, and I do research, teach, and engage communities through Portland State University as a professor of climate adaptation.
My name is Aaron Golub. I am an associate professor and the department chair in the School of Urban Studies and Planning at Portland State University.
My name is Nico Larco. I am the director of the Urbanism Next Center at the University of Oregon and professor of architecture and urban design.
The first thing we really need to jump into here, Kelly, is the relationship between the urban lifestyle and the cities a lot of us call home and the environment.
When we've talked about the impact of climate change on forests or farms, we've been talking about places where there are less people. So how do you study what climate change is doing and going to do to these places where a lot more people live? And what do you do with that information?
What cities are doing is, in that description of those hazards that climate change is creating, they're developing mitigation plans and hazard management plans within that context. And so that includes, like, which communities are most affected by specific climate-induced stressors, what are the infrastructure systems that might be really vulnerable to impacts from these different climate stressors, and what are the roles and responsibilities of different agencies from the state, regional to local level in terms of being able to bolster or kind of improve the conditions of the communities that are hit hardest and the infrastructure that's hit hardest. I tend to think about it as the intersection of climate-induced forces on a region, what are known and not known about those forces, and then what are the ways we can design our social systems and our infrastructure to be able to respond to those changes effectively so that fewer people are impacted and less infrastructure is impacted.
And the idea of how to build cities to better interact with their environment has been around for a lot longer than the idea of climate change and the rise in global temperatures that's driven by our use of fossil fuels.
Urban studies and urban planning are a field that developed around 100 to 150 years ago to try and think more systematically and more scientifically about our growing urban environments that had been until then pretty haphazardly put together. Cities, even to today, are mostly groupings of private activity. Most of the building stock is private, and most of the activities that happen are private. But around 150 years ago, people realized that that didn't lead to very healthy, very vibrant, very safe environments without some kind of thinking more systematically about how humans lived or could live in cities and how they could be made better. And so they tried to apply more rational health and environment-based thinking to the problems of the urban, which 150 years ago were toxic air pollution, noise. You had industry next to homes, next to feedlots, next to ports. Those who could afford to would move out of cities. But for the rest of people, 90%, they had to live in cities next to all of that nuisance. So planners began to think about how could we make things more livable by taking on a kind of a public lens on what is still mostly a private thing. And by planning in a way, thinking forward about population growth, about the needs for recreation, non-private activities, schools, hospitals. And so planners and urban scholars think about how we do this urban activity, this urban development, how can we do it better? And what are the various tools and metrics that we would use to say that an urban area is livable? Is it just? Is it environmentally sustainable?
One of the big questions we've been trying to answer throughout this podcast series is, why does this all matter to me? Well, as you'll hear in our third episode, the threats to people brought on by climate change are very real and very serious. Listen to the way Portland State Professor Vivek Shandes explains some of the many dangers we could be facing.
In brief, cities are first trying to describe what are some of the impacts that climate change is going to create for them. So I'm seeing a lot around flooding. I'm seeing a lot around landslides. I'm seeing a lot around fires, often adjacent to cities in forested areas like in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm starting to see an increased interest in heat and the kind of rising temperatures and the impact that has on health and well-being of communities. I tend to think about kind of more rainfall. What does that mean to our ability to like keep our basements, keep our homes not flooded? Like we are in an urban environment. We've sealed up a lot of the surfaces of our cities with concrete and asphalt. And so when the rainwater falls and the pipes aren't big enough to be able to take all that water out with the amount of rain we're seeing, then that means we see flooding. And so neighborhood flooding has become a really big issue. It can keep people from being able to get to work. It can really reduce your ability to kind of keep a safe, mold-free environment, for example, because with more rain comes other things like mold and higher humidity. And then, of course, with heat, we're seeing issues of people dying directly from heat-related illnesses. In fact, the heat dome that came through in late June is arguably the first set of climate-related fatalities that we've seen in the Pacific Northwest. And so if we see greater intensity and more frequent heat waves coming through the region, then our health and well-being is going to be highly compromised because our body has a very narrow threshold as to what it will maintain as a healthy core environment. And if we aren't able to find cooling resources to keep our bodies cool during the heat waves, and if we have any rolling brownouts or blackouts where even those people who have AC and can run AC aren't able to stay cool, then the body is going to have some serious impacts and we're likely going to see a spike in deaths as a result. We're really just starting to document a lot of these empirically, and that's where it's going to become very real when we start seeing what's the way we're building our cities, what's the way we're designing our individual developments, our roads, and our homes, so that we can reduce those health-related impacts.
And Kelly, as you will hear, it's not just an issue of our physical well-being. Climate change is proving to be damaging our mental state, our psyche, too.
Yeah, we've already got a field of psychology that's emerging that I'm watching really closely of climate anxiety. And this is something that's starting to emerge not only with older adults, this is something that we're starting to document in younger children as well. Children as early as 5 are describing real serious concerns about the future of the planet and about the wildfires combined with the heat waves, combined with winter torrential rains, and flooding. Children are so receptive to what's happening around them. And I think they're picking up on these indications of what's happening and the shifts that are happening in our environment and our own, of course, anxiety that they're observing in terms of what we can do about it. And so that's where the mental stress and the overall mental health of communities I'm really concerned about, because it really comes down to what can we do about this and how much efficacy do I have in being able to directly change the environment around which I live so that I can be better prepared and more resilient as a result of the changing climate. And so communities that are often experiencing the heavy burden of climate stress, climate anxiety, climate depression, I think are really communities that we need to be engaging and identifying therapeutics that could really support people in taking action at the local level so that we can really be prepared for whatever comes our way, because ultimately that's going to enable us to get through the next heat wave or the next flood.
Now that we've got an idea of how climate change is threatening our way of life, and in some cases, literally threatening our lives, we need to talk about what can be done about it.
Annian, we asked the experts we talked to for this episode if they felt cities were rising to the challenge. And some of the answers weren't very encouraging.
I feel like we're not doing it anywhere near enough compared to what we need to be doing. How would cities deal with the issue that we are going to have, hotter temperatures, more wildfires, less water available? It frightens me because a lot of cities aren't dealing with it.
I don't think we're there yet. I think what we're doing right now in Portland is trying to react a little bit to the low-hanging fruit. You have some extreme days, you open some cooling centers, you might give out some box fans. Wealthier households will start retrofitting their homes for air conditioning. Of course, not everyone can spend $10,000 to do that. And so I think everyone else for the next decade will just kind of deal with the punches as they come.
So as we saw with the recent heat dome event that happened in late June 2021 here in the Pacific Northwest, we were caught really flat-footed in this event and climate-induced event that it was. We were opening up cooling shelters like the Saturday of the day that the heat dome was descending upon us. We were trying to reach out to communities like in real time. And so what that suggests to me, along with the fact that we had almost 100 people just in the Portland metro region that died as a result of this heat dome that came through, that we are really not quite doing as much as we could to prepare ourselves for the rapid onset of climate-induced stressors that we're experiencing, not only in the Pacific Northwest, but many parts around the country. We're already seeing a rapid rise in air conditioning units as an example of infrastructure vulnerability in the region. Our electrical grids are not well set up to be able to have that run on AC that we're already seeing happening right now. We're up at about 53% air conditioning in the city of Portland. And that number has been slowly ticking up over the years as temperatures have gotten warmer and people have seen that that's a direct way of being able to cool themselves off in their homes or businesses. And so we need to really get our electrical system and our grid system much more ready for these hotter summers and potentially colder winters that we're seeing.
So if cities aren't necessarily prepared for the perils of climate change, we wanted to know what, if anything, they are trying to do.
So some of the ways that people are adapting is really, I would say, defensive, right? So there are things like wildfires that are happening. There are things like sea level rise that is happening. You look at the coastal cities, especially along the East Coast, and that is a real threat they see, every day. And so that, they're doing mitigation efforts in terms of trying to create seawalls or trying to shift a little bit where development happens.
We also need to start thinking about green infrastructure and what are the ways we can cool our cities and absorb that rainwater in wintertime so that we're not seeing as much flooding or extreme heat waves, because green infrastructure like trees, parks, open space, even green walls and green roofs do a lot for cooling an environment and absorbing that excess rainwater that we're going to expect because of a rise in temperatures and destabilization of the climate system.
Before Aaron Golub got to Portland State University, he spent some time in Phoenix, Arizona, paying particular attention to the ways in which a city accustomed to much more heat than we usually see here is dealing with rising temperatures.
And so with the drier and hotter climate, we're going to have to think about possibly water conservation, possibly thinking about shading in our public spaces, and how do we keep ourselves cool under more extreme conditions. in places like Phoenix that have dealt with it, they've thought carefully about the pedestrians in public space where they walk, so making sure that they are continuously shaded. But some of those ideas have already made their way to Portland as more of a public infrastructure around the tree canopy. There is a lot of thinking in Portland around the tree canopy. They not only cool in the shade underneath, but they're respirating, so they are cooling the environment around them. In Phoenix, a lot of research showed how important a single tree could be to reduce temperatures on a 110-degree day. Around it, it's, you know, in the 80s. You can't plant a tree everywhere, but maybe we'll have shaded bike lanes or shaded bus stops and MAC stops and things like that.
When we look at the effects climate change is going to have on the urban landscape, we need to take a good look at the way a lot of city dwellers are choosing to live and the consequences of those choices.
But if you look at the underlying issues causing climate change, the instigators, a lot of that has to do with greenhouse gas emissions, and that is completely tied to our development patterns and our transportation patterns. Generally in the country, we still have a generally low density development. Suburban sprawl is the development of choice, which just spreads us out even more, makes our metropolitan footprints even larger. The larger distances we have to travel, it forces us into cars, which then means we need parking areas for these cars. And that just has this cascading effect on problems with energy, with environment.
This is really important. And I wanted to get a better idea of what Nico was trying to say when it comes to this idea of urban density and how the ways in which we are choosing to live can have a negative impact on the environment.
Yeah, and he used a great example of having a backyard to make his point.
One of the classes I teach on sustainable urbanism, I go through this really like one kind of cascading steps of, I'm kind of this innocent person. And, you know, let's say I'm not really politically active and I'm not really following climate change or anything. You know, I really like a yard, or yard's like a really nice thing to have. And so, you know, I like barbecues and I like, you know, having my kids be able to play out in the yard and having friends over and all that. So I want to have a yard, right? All right. Well, in US, you know, developing typically means that, you know, I develop in areas where everyone around me has something similar, right? So everyone around me has a yard, right? Which makes us all of a sudden to be a little bit further away from each other. For me to get from one place to another, the distances start to get a little bit larger. And therefore, because they're a little bit larger, well, now I kind of need a car to get from one place to another. And because those distances are larger, transit doesn't really work because the densities aren't high enough. Well, now I actually need a car. So I need a place to store my car in my house, which means I need a garage. So we just, like, now everyone has a garage and that expands us all even further. And now when I go to the grocery store, I'm going to be there with a car, which means that I need to have a parking lot there, which expands things even further. And now because I'm driving back and forth to that grocery store and to everywhere else so much, the streets that I used to feel okay walking on, I don't feel okay walking on. I don't feel okay biking on. I do less of those trips on other modes, and it pushes me more and more to the car. I need more parking. I need more wider roads, right? And it pushes everything further and further and further apart. And so that's where we're at right now. This decision, this kind of innocent decision of like, I just like having a backyard and like being able to throw the ball around and like grow a lawn, right? So I try to make the link of these innocent decision of like, I like to live with a cascades into these much larger issues and all those issues, right? Land consumption, habitat depletion, energy consumption because of the way that we're moving around are all the things that are causing the climate change that then we're trying to mitigate.
Kelly, this idea of density and how increasing it in the near future could have some very positive impacts on improving our relationship with the environment came up quite a bit in our conversation with Amanda Howell from Urbanism Next at the University of Oregon.
I think what I'm excited about 50 years down the road, we are living in denser communities, really reducing the amount of parking. There is so much space we waste on parking. And so I think all of the incredible creative ways that we could use that space better, more efficiently for green space and, you know, denser housing and everything we've seen, you know, with opening up our streets for people and allowing there to be, you know, people in the streets. These are not new concepts, but the fact that some of these things might stay and we could see more and more of it, like for me, that is really exciting to think about in 50 years, where there is this sort of more vibrant cities where people are actually, you know, in many ways living closer together with more green space, much less driving. The closer together we live, the shorter distances that we have to travel to get to where we work and where we shop, you know, the greater efficiencies there are, the better that is for climate change, the better that is for emissions.
The importance of increasing urban density was something Nico Larco stressed as well.
how do you create cities that are going to be helping with the climate problems we have? We are talking about dense cities. We're talking about multimodal cities, not so much reliance on the car, mixed use cities, all these types of things. And honestly, in the United States, we have some fantastic examples where these things are happening, right? Are being pushed. I've put Portland definitely as part of that. We need to have denser cities. And I'm not talking about Hong Kong. I'm not talking about New York. We're not talking like enormous, you know, street canyons, everyone living in high rises. There's a ton of wonderful options. Talking specifically about Portland, some of the policies that we've been doing, I think, are correct. We've done a fantastic job of calling for densifying centers and corridors. It's just that that density largely isn't happening yet. The city of Portland has very few duplexes, has very few triplexes, right? Doing these types of things that double, triple our density and yet feel good, right? Feel like nice neighborhoods that you want to be in is, I think, a really important piece that we need to do.
So we've got this issue in cities. This lack of density and sprawl into the suburbs puts more people in cars and more cars on the road. And that means we need more roads.
And so we kept building roadways and we really kind of stayed with the status quo. Some cities made investments in public transit or bicycling, as did Portland, but not all did. And it really has been mostly a failure.
But there are transit systems in place and rideshare that, if designed and used correctly, should be able to help reduce the need for cars.
If we can use a lot of these technologies, for instance, on the transportation side, to get us to think of not that I need my own private automobile that I keep at my house and, like, you know, spend 95% of the time parked somewhere along the city and I need all that land for those things, but instead that, oh, I've got lots of different options of how I can move around, of which a car is one of them. It might not be my own private car, right? So I'll use transit, or I'll use a scooter, or I'll use microtransit, right? So like shared rides, or a whole host of things that could actually reduce the amount that we actually need cars.
Rideshare isn't the only modern development that came up in our discussions for this episode. There's also the idea that cars and buses and delivery trucks may not need drivers at all. And that, combined with more dense urban landscapes, could further reduce the need for everyone to have a car.
To the extent that I think it makes sense with technology and having autonomous trains and autonomous buses and things like that, automated shuttles, because we live like closer together. So an autonomous shuttle that can go, 25 miles an hour and takes us around and gets us to where we need to be, that is really exciting.
When we come back, we'll take a look at the world of e-commerce and the role it could play in helping mitigate climate change in the urban landscape. But there's a catch.
Hi, this is Jeff Giannola from Coin6 News, and I'd like to invite you to watch Coin6 News at 10 on Portland CW. It's our award-winning newscast, 1 hour earlier at 10 o'clock. A full hour of the stories that are important to you and your family from the news team that's watching out for you. Plus, Portland's most accurate forecast certified by WeatherRate from Chief Meteorologist Natasha Stenbach. See why more people are switching to Coin6 News at 10 on Portland CW. Watching out for you.
The Coin6 weather team has the most accurate forecast in town, certified by WeatherRate. Coin6 Weather, watching out for you.
So Kelly, I don't know how things are at your house, but between Target.com and Amazon and others, we've got 5 or 6 or 10 packages showing up at our front door every week.
Ian, I got you beat. I have like 20. And here's the problem. Those delivery trucks are carrying a lot of packages to a lot of houses, but that is a lot of trips and a lot of miles.
If it continues to be incredibly cheap or even free to just feel like we're having every single thing delivered without consequence, you can just make whatever decision is best for you without necessarily feeling the price of that decision. How does that impact people's behavior in terms of, like, are they actually just substituting those trips that they might otherwise have taken to the store to have things delivered? Is it a one-for-one substitution? Or are they ordering something and then they're taking another trip? And I think that gets to the kind of heart of your question, which is, like, are we actually taking vehicles off the street with some of these things? And I think The answer right now is no, in a lot of ways. I think that right now, because we don't necessarily have the policies in place to sort of impact behavior, it feels additive. It feels like it's the convenience factor. So we're taking advantage of the convenience, but we're not necessarily substituting. And I think that's where it gets to. We need to incentivize the types of behavior we would like to see, and we need to disincentivize the types of behavior that we need to move away from.
And Nico Larco from the Urbanism Next Center at the University of Oregon says there are numbers to back that up.
There's a number of studies that have shown that actually e-commerce actually increases the amount of vehicle miles traveled. I've got six Amazon trucks coming to my door as opposed to just me driving to the grocery store once, right, and grabbing that thing, not to mention all the returns.
So if having a lot of stuff delivered right to our doors is driving up the miles driven on our roads and increasing emissions, what about the idea of moving all of those goods, all of that stuff, closer to our houses?
That's where this growing movement of urban warehousing comes in. And this is something you can see in our area in places like Troutdale or Hillsborough.
So I think something that maybe we're not noticing quite as much yet, especially in urban areas, is the fact that there is starting to be a growth of urban warehousing, and we're starting to try and find ways increasingly to move goods closer and closer to us in order to reduce the amount of time that it takes between, you know, us ordering something and then having it delivered or being able to go and pick it up from somewhere nearby. And I think that that's actually something that many of us probably aren't thinking a lot about. We're not thinking about how far away something is coming from. And I think the fact that it's starting to sort of get integrated into our cities in really interesting ways, like increasingly places that have maybe been exclusively retail where you're going in and shopping, are there's starting to be sort of this shift where retail and warehousing are melding together into one, more of one land use.
And Amanda says that's just the beginning of the way cities and retailers are looking at trying to reduce the need for so much traffic to be tied to delivering goods to our door.
You know, I think that there's some really exciting things that we're starting to try and see and find ways to make things more efficient as a way to respond to climate change. So as we move further into the future and I get out my crystal ball and I think, like, what else is really exciting? Again, my focus here is really so much on sort of the automated delivery side and also ways that we can shift to more sustainable modes. And so increasingly we're seeing, you know, cities be really interested in testing out electrified delivery fleets and companies, you know, making pledges that they're going to move towards fully electric fleets. I think it's exciting when we see things like shared micro hub lockers, you know, because right now you might have an Amazon locker and maybe you have a DHL locker and everybody's separate. But what if you can combine carriers and we could have them in neighborhoods and you walk down the street to get your package? It's just there at the end of the block. I think some of the newer, flashier technologies we're seeing in some limited places, like the sidewalk delivery robots, they are doing some testing of them down in Corvallis. So some of these little slightly flashier technologies exist in limited areas. And that's all still coming from this place of, like, it's not the most efficient thing in the world to have a large vehicle driving around a burrito because you ordered it to have delivered. You know, I think having a robot bring it to you if it's a short distance probably does make more sense.
We talked quite a bit in our second episode when we were focusing on the timber and agriculture industries that climate change is already costing the global economy a lot of money, and the concern that those costs are going to rise well into the trillions of dollars in the coming decades.
But we also introduced the idea that with the damage being done to the economy by continued climate change, you can see a bit of a silver lining.
I absolutely think there is opportunity in the future. I think people are incredibly resilient and incredibly creative. You know, I think we always have been. And I think as much as we can, the idea of trying to embrace where there are opportunities and, you know, new jobs and new industries that will arise as we shift and as we adapt, I think it's really fascinating. I think there's absolutely a lot of opportunity in the future.
On the flip side, while that economic opportunity could prove to be profitable for companies and industries that show a willingness to shift in the future, there is concern that not adapting to climate change correctly could significantly compound one of the biggest problems facing us today.
I think the issue that is not a new issue is whether or not we are investing and we are training and providing the education opportunities and creating a playing field that allows people to really take advantage. That, I think, continues to be the issue and the question, that is not new. You know, I think that there's some really exciting things that we're starting to try and see and find ways to make things more efficient as a way to respond to climate change that also have other important implications, you know, in terms of our economy and, you know, hopefully at the end of the day too, really important equity implications, you know, that we're making things better for everybody.
Let's stop right there for a second. You heard Amanda just mention the equity implications that come along with climate change.
Safe to say, Ian, there's a real concern that as climate change continues to force changes in our urban landscape, that there is a risk certain groups of people are going to suffer more than others.
And that's exactly what we're going to get into right on the other side of the break. Who's at most risk from the adverse effects of climate change? And what do we need to do to mitigate the danger?
Hello, Coin6 News anchor Emily Burris here. We know your mornings are busy, and we want to help you be in the know as you head out the door. That's why the Coin Podcast Network is bringing you a brand new podcast called The Daily Six. Every weekday, we'll bring you the day's six biggest headlines in a quick and concise report, on demand and on your schedule. So check out the Coin Podcast Network on coin.com or have The Daily Six sent directly to you each day by subscribing to the Coin Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, this is Jeff Giannola from Coin6 News, and I'd like to invite you to watch Coin6 News at 10 on Portland CW, a full hour of the stories that are important to you and your family. See why more people are switching to Coin6 News at 10 on Portland CW.
Climate change hits the communities that are poor, have been historically marginalized, so those are communities of color, harder than it does others.
I guess, Kelly, we can call it disparity, we can call it inequity, we can refer to it as the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. But no matter how we refer to it, from the discussions you and I have had throughout this process and our deep dive into the dangers of climate change, I know this point, this is a major point of concern for you.
Yeah, a good example I think about in this situation is the heat wave. You know, some people have air conditioning. Some folks can go out and buy an air conditioner, but not everybody can afford air conditioning. Listen to Professor Vivek Shandez from Portland State University explain how not only are people in lower income neighborhoods less equipped to deal with the certain elements of climate change, but in those places, climate change can actually be worse. And he's got the data to prove it.
We've conducted a series of different analyses looking at, for example, communities that have been historically segregated in urban planning processes and finding that those areas that were segregated as what we call redlined communities, those are communities that are often lower income, immigrant, or communities of color, often African-American communities, live in areas that are in the Portland region about 13 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than their non-redline counterparts. And so that was a study that we did of 108 cities across the country and found that Portland was top of the list when it came to the difference between segregated communities and those that weren't. That really sends a clear signal to me and to the scholarly as well as the practitioner communities that we have a lot of work ahead of us to kind of undo some of those historical wrongs that policy has already created. That is a data question. Like, that's an information question. That's a technology question. What happens when a heat wave comes through? What neighborhoods are hotter? What streets are hotter? Which households are hotter? Which ones have better ability to use AC and not be highly inefficient in the use of AC? Because these are very uncertain times. And what we need during uncertain times is a better way to register the differences that are occurring between one city block and another city block, and technologies that are able to really describe at a very detailed level how one neighbor is experiencing climate change very differently than another neighbor, not only helps underscore the need for kind of seeing those differences, it also really shows a lot of the inequities and the challenges that communities are facing when it comes to coping with hotter temperatures, more rainfall, sea level rise, et cetera. from a social side, we really need to find out how to engage those communities that are hardest hit from climate-induced stressors. That's developing communication systems, that's developing engagement programs that are community-based. So everybody in a particular neighborhood on a particular street knows what options they have when a heat wave is about to fall upon the city or a flood is imminent in an area.
Before the break, Amanda Howell from Urbanism Next was talking about the economic opportunities that could come as cities and urban industries adapt to climate change. But she also mentioned her concern about certain segments of the population at risk of being left behind.
It's frustrating because I just think absolutely there are opportunities. We just have to be ready to seize them and make sure that we are giving people the opportunity to take advantage of those jobs, of the new industries that are coming to be as we speak that we can't even really think about right now because I can't even conceptualize of them. You know, we don't know exactly what's coming next, but the issue again is whether or not we're really providing the workforce training and educational opportunities in a way that allows people to take advantage of those. We have just seen the divide grow and grow. And it's such an inequitable system today already in terms of what people have access to, in terms of the jobs that they are able to seek and the education opportunities that they are able to seek. And there's certainly an economic equity issue here and a labor equity issue here. You know, there will be some jobs that will go away, but there will be some new opportunities that come up. But again, it's a huge equity issue whether or not we are providing opportunities for people to transition into those new jobs as they appear, or whether or not we are just sort of allowing the divide, the economic divide, the equity divide to continue to grow.
I mentioned air conditioning and access to air conditioning a few minutes ago, and that's something that came up in our discussion with Professor Shondez, and how can illustrate the dangerous differences between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to a continued rise in global temperatures.
When we look at air conditioning, which is one of the most effective ways to reduce heat-related deaths, we see that when it gets above 90 degrees in the Portland metro region, a lot of communities who have air conditioning and can run it because they have financial capital, they have money in their pockets, they're running the AC. Those communities are often also in the cooler parts of town. And we found differences in the Portland region of about 13 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit difference from one part of town to another at the same time. And those that are in the coolest parts of town are running their AC and creating an even cooler environment for them to be in. Whereas those that are in the hotter parts of town don't have access to AC or are unable to run it because of lack of financial assistance or capital that they have. And so they're getting the harder hit of that heat wave than folks who are able to run their AC units. And so that's a very simple but very poignant example as to how that inequity plays out during a heat wave.
There was one other thing that came from the data he has been referencing that helped me really grasp this issue. Listen to what Professor Shondez found out when he went looking for real-world evidence that climate change has a disproportionate effect in disadvantaged communities.
I recently got a hold of the addresses of everybody who died during the last heat dome event that came through. And I went to each one of those locations to not only give a tribute to the people who live there and whose lives are directly attributable to climate change, I was also able to capture the kind of built environment that these individuals who died, the conditions in which they lived. And many of them are in trailer parks. Many of them are in single family residential homes that are very much some of the hottest places in the region. Many of them are in multifamily residential homes, often in upper floors that don't have access to AC. And so those floors, as you know, heat rises, and keeping that heat trapped in an apartment can be really impactful to our health and well-being. So we've seen that the discriminating and silent killer that heat is directly attributable to the inequities that we've already seen play out in much of the region. And this is not an unfamiliar story to many other parts of the country as well who have endured very similar results.
Identifying that we have a problem is one thing, and it is a first step. But how are we going to go about fixing it in a way that is equitable? And how do we make sure as few people as possible feel the brunt of continued climate change?
So how do we measure fairness in our planning? How do we include all communities in planning? One of my specialties is thinking carefully about social justice and how different communities are involved or not, and how they benefit or not from our investments. So in many communities have been excluded from some of the big benefits of urban growth. And so my specialty is kind of thinking carefully about that.
I would just point to a couple of different examples. One is just thinking about reaching out to the communities who might be experiencing vulnerability. That's something we just talked about, and ensuring that they have, during a heat event, that they have access to cooling resources, that they have transportation to cooling resources, that we actually prioritize the health and well-being of communities that have historically been marginalized and often invisible to larger public. And the second is to do what I've been referring to as deep energy retrofits of existing building stock to make sure that the buildings that we live in, especially those that are lower income, marginalized communities, have a quality of building that actually stays cool during a heat wave. And that can be through energy assistance programs where we're not only insulating the building a lot better, creating much less porousness of that hot air from the outside into the household, but we're also creating retrofits that allow an AC unit to show up and to keep the temperature in that space cool. And then, of course, to be able to subsidize AC for specific qualifying residences so that they can stay cool in that environment. It's really all about values and priorities, whether we really value the life and health of those communities who are really vulnerable, often because of no cause of their own, and trying to find avenues to be able to support those communities through our policy, our engagement, and our communication efforts.
So, Kelly, here we are, wrapping up episode 3 in our series on climate change. And we've taken a look at how modern city design and urban sprawl is increasing carbon emissions, which is the leading cause of global temperature rise. We've looked at how e-commerce, while convenient, is contributing to the problem, and how we can evolve to reduce its impact. And we've spent a lot of time talking about how historically marginalized communities will bear the brunt of climate change unless we alter the way we adapt going forward.
Yeah, Ian, and like a lot of things we've covered so far in this series, there's some scary stuff here. Legitimate concerns that human suffering is going to increase as the climate continues to change. But as we have in the first two episodes, we want to end by talking about hope and what gives our experts reason to believe we will be able to figure this out.
You know, I think cities are willing to try things. I think that is actually really exciting. I think that increasingly we're starting to see more willingness, I think, to pilot new technologies and then iterate and learn. And so we realize the time to act is now. We have to do something.
I think it's actually some of the best things that could be happening are these basically like making wonderful, easily accessible places that allow us to move around fairly seamlessly without using a lot of energy. I'll say the whole shift to electrification that we're seeing in cars, but also in buses and all sorts of transit is a fantastic push forward. And hopefully it's going to do a whole lot to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. That's, I think, probably one of the best things that we're seeing happening right now.
Climate change, unlike a lot of other environmental issues, is really something that requires all of us to participate. It really is everybody's issue. What we really need to be talking about are conversations that identify what are the ways that I, as an individual, we as a family, we as a neighborhood, could really be contributing to preparing ourselves for a shifting climate, because that will, in the long run, make a difference. Being prepared is a really helpful step for us to move into a much more positive and effective approach to addressing something that's generally so out of our control.
As we continue adapting and attempting to mitigate climate change, one of the biggest questions we've been running into is whose responsibility is it to get us moving in the right direction?
Is it mine or yours? Is it a personal decision that starts at home? Or is it something that needs to be encouraged and demanded by government at all levels? That's what we will get into next week as our conversation about climate change and our COIN Podcast Network series, Climate in Crisis, continues.
The COIN Podcast Network is your home for on-demand coverage of local news, sports, weather, and entertainment you won't find anywhere else. You can always find us on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.